Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out this evening. Thank you, virtual audience. And Christina, who is dressed somewhat like a strawberry daiquiri and looks absolutely beautiful, was saying she was happy that she didn't have one before she came. But when we opened this bookstore in 1999, it was just before Sue Grafton's book tour for Emma's for Murder. So we were really good friends, and I wrote to her, and I said, how's your book tour shaping up? And she said, is that code for saying, please come to the store and open it? And I said, yes. And so she came, and there were 1,500 people that came. We didn't have a talk, obviously. Everybody wound around the block, and, you know, the cops were here and the whole bit. And she was set up there by the bathroom so that people could go all the way around the store and exit out that way. So she was at a table right there, and at some point our then attorney was there. She was wearing a long jacket. She was all dressed up. She looked really great. And at some point, unknowns to all of us, some woman stumbled down the alley from the Mexican restaurant on the corner down there, who'd been drinking strawberry daiquiris, and she came in the door and threw up all over Sue. I mean, all over this flood. And Marianne, with great aplomb, grabbed Sue, whipped her into the bathroom, sponged her off, and then wrapped her up in her coat. As there she were like a two-year-old, and put her back at the table. And we continued. I mean, you know.
That's the best Sue Grafton story I've heard.
That's a true Sue Grafton story. But anyway, the words strawberry daiquiri strike terror to my heart whenever they come up in relation to the bookstore. So thank you very much for not doing that. So we are here to celebrate the publication. Actually, this is the pre-publication party, so very special. And you should get Christina to put the date in your book, because it doesn't really publish till tomorrow, of her debut mystery, Off the Air. So exciting. Give her a round of applause. And we have quite a history with this book, don't we, you
yes,
and I?
Yes, we do.
Right. Why don't you describe it?
Well, I would never have done this had I known that Barbara actually reads early drafts from some really well-known, kick-ass, excuse my language, authors. I didn't know any of that when I approached her and asked her to read my really bad early draft. And she was kind enough to do that and kind enough to point out some areas to work on. Let's put it that way. Is that a strawberry?
It was daiquiri? Really well said. So, whew. I'm glad I wasn't drinking a strawberry daiquiri just at that moment. Right. We did have several fairly brisk discussions about, you know, I think oftentimes when you see the end product here, you think that that's the book, you know, that's the way it was written from the get-go. And it's never like that, is it?
I thought it was going to be.
Right. Well, you were a first-time author, so you didn't know better. But in general, books grow. And, you know, they need revision, oftentimes input. The author, in fact, I know we had a discussion that you would like to perhaps have written some other things into this book way too late because it had already been printed, right?
Yeah, yeah. I checked, and this book actually went into production in January 2023. So it's March 2024 going to be in your hands. So that's sort of how long the process can take. And so that's 14 months where I've had time to think about woulda, coulda, shoulda. And as Barbara pointed out, no, you can't, too late.
Yeah, you just have to live with it. That, it didn't used to be quite that long, but COVID and all the supply chain problems, you know, the printers going out of business and not getting paper in the whole bit, really lengthened out the process. And I find it incredible, for example, that I already know what we're doing next October. Because they're now working so far ahead. So I'm not surprised that your book was that. But, you know, one thing I really love is the cover. Isn't it fun? Love the color. Love the little, you know, sketches and all. I think it's...
Can I take credit? I have zero role in that. No, I was... Well, let me give myself some credit. I knew enough to say that's not my area. So you guys are the experts and you do what you need to do. And they came back with this and one other. And They were tied, and I chose this one because I liked seeing all of the different people around.
Absolutely. Plus, turquoise is sort of an Arizona color, right? So you all know that this book was submitted and won the Tony Hillerman Prize for, yay!
Thank you.
For a mystery set in the Southwest, and other winners, many of them have been far more Western. So I love the fact that this one is set in Phoenix. You know, it is not really a Tony Hillman book, but I love the fact that the prize has that much scope, you know, that Jolene and her adventures can qualify.
Yay. I love being able to put Phoenix out there. I read so many crime fiction series that I love, and so many are set in Minneapolis and Boston and L.A. and Chicago, and I just want to read more set in Phoenix.
Me too. So we do have one author here, Jen McKinley, who bases her one of her series. What is it? Which cupcake shop
Fairy
is it?
Fairy Tale Cupcakes.
Yes. No. But the real cut is whatever. I can't. Sprinkles, right. It's a version, the Fairy Tale Cupcake
Fairy
Mysteries
tale
are set
better.
On. Right, sprinkles up the way. But you're right, there are not many novels set in Phoenix. Betty Webb wrote some for mm-hmm. Poison Pen Press, but she's moved on to 1920s Paris, having abandoned Phoenix. I know. So anyway, you have brought with you to this book your long experience as a reporter. And you obviously have really seen how your job has evolved. So one of the things I thought a real takeaway from this book is to recognize how much the news industry now depends on clicks and clickbait. So all of us who wonder every day why Donald Trump is the headline in every news, everything, and that's part of it. It's just because, you know, he's clickbait, right?
Social media has dramatically changed journalism and a lot of other industries as well. And it's certainly addressed in the book. It has to be addressed in the book. In fact, it changes so much that in my author's note, I note that please forgive all the Twitter references because...
It's already X, right?
Yeah. I mean, not because I'm not bashing the platform, but because, yeah, it was an interesting conversation I had with my editor because as a reporter, I freaked out because I was like, oh my gosh, are they going to change the name? Are they not? What, you know, I need to go back and fix everything in the book. And, you know, publishing is a different world than journalism. And they're not going to be like, stop the presses so she can change every Twitter reference to X. So there is an author's note in there that asks people to understand that it's crazy environment. And we in journalism, as well as publishing, can't necessarily keep up with all the social media.
I love the fact that whenever anybody refers to X in the media, they always go X, formerly known as Twitter.
So it makes me think of Prince.
I don't think anybody will really go wrong reading your book. So talk to us about Jolene. I made some questions, or actually you made some questions, mm-hmm. but then I kept track of them. Hold on a minute while I find them. Which is three things that inspired you to write off the air. So the first would be my love of mysteries, especially series. Why do you like series?
Thank you, because I didn't know what the answer was until you just cued me. Thank you. No, I love series because it's sort of like visiting friends. And hopefully that doesn't sound cheesy, but I can't because mystery series are really popular. So I can't be the only one that feels that way. It's like going back to whatever city or whatever town or whatever rural area to visit the characters that you love and to see what's happening in their lives and how they're growing and changing.
I definitely think that that people get invested in the characters. Oftentimes, in fact, you see other series sprout from an original series because people get so interested in one of the... Michael Connelly is a great example. Well, his mistake was aging Harry in real time, so he's forced to have other characters because Harry's too old to work at the LAPD anymore. He'll be here in November with a new book in which I think it now says... trying to remember her name, Renee Ballard, with Harry Bosch or something, you know, in order to do that. I also think that locations, you know, some series are set up so that the character can move to different landscapes and, you know, and we're all okay with that. Nevada Bar's National Park series was an example of that. Certainly Reacher, you know, on a bus every time to a new place. So that works really well. But most series are really rooted in a particular community, aren't they?
They are. And, I mean, Phoenix is so big, contrary to what some in the New York publishing world still think about us, we are the fifth largest city. And I say that because I know that there are people outside watching on Facebook or YouTube, either now or later. So thank you for doing that. But some people still think Phoenix is sort of a small town or we're rural or something. So there's a lot here in Phoenix, and I have plenty of places that Jolene can visit and certainly plenty of stories and people and places to explore.
Oh, there are a lot of stories in Phoenix. I know. And, you know, I have to give credit. No, that's not your thing. But I do think the Arizona Republic has really dug in to do some investigative reporting recently, and they've been doing a really remarkable job. So good for them. I hope.
Absolutely.
We need more. The number of papers has shrunk. Remember, you know, we used to have at least three, I think, and now basically it's the Republic. So we'll hope that Gannett doesn't fold up. But anyway, all right, so second, we've already touched on this. My love for Phoenix. I never expected to stay past my initial three-year contract here in TV news. So how long ago did you come to Phoenix?
That was more than 20 years ago. I came here to work for the ABC station, Channel 15 here, and I moved here in the summer. I know. I excitedly moved here in the summer.
Right.
This was the big city.
It was probably before the 119 degree, you know.
It was more like 110 then.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but I moved here and I had only been in the Midwest. So I was always used to green, green, green. And then I moved here in the summer when it's hot and brown and weird. So
why did you stay?
Isn't that weird? It grows on you. But, you know, you can ask other people that. Well, one, of course, the winters are gorgeous, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I really think another part of it is that I developed friendships that have just lasted forever and ever and ever. And I think that's part of where home is, right? Your friends are your chosen family.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can be with your chosen family, that's a great place to be.
Well, and you've been very successful in your career too. Wouldn't that make a difference too? So, and third, your love for local news. I've been reporting for more than 20 years and wanted to recognize that thousands of people who work in more than 200 local TV markets across the United States. So is there basically a similarity, you know, despite the different cities and all the rest of it, is a local TV market kind of a thing?
I think it's a unique work environment and experience. Like maybe working on a campaign is sort of a unique experience for those people involved in the campaign, because there are really highs and lows depending on what you're working on that day. And oftentimes you're stuck with one person in a truck or a car for 8, 10, 12 hours. I mean, sometimes you're spending more time with a photographer if you're a reporter than you do with your significant other. That makes for some interesting conversations, some experiences, some, you know, happy and not so happy times. And you're just covering the gamut from, you know, really happy stories to really horrible, heartbreaking stories that really impact you and can really stay with you.
Right. I'm trying to think how best to move on from, I know what I was going to say. Crime fiction. I mean, it's fiction, right? So you get to make everything up. But at the same time, the best crime fiction feels authentic. So you feel as though the person writing it actually knows what they're talking about. Maybe you don't need a sensitivity reader, for example, to write about reporting. But that's becoming a thing to try to make writers more authentic, I guess is the right word.
You know what's interesting? You say I don't need somebody to read about reporting.
And you did have one?
No. But I've heard some people, this hurts. I know people don't necessarily like reporters, but I was surprised by some people who were like, oh man, I wouldn't ever want to be a reporter. And I just thought, oh, but we're not that bad. we're really not. We're people. But it's just, you know, and it's an interesting time, right? I understand sometimes you see stories and you think there's a zillion reasons a story turns out the way that it does. But it's just been interesting to me how some people were turned off by that work environment. Like somebody said to me, oh, it's a hostile work environment. And I was like, it is? Like it didn't seem that way. And I actually emailed a couple of friends just a couple of days ago. I go, did we just get used to that, or is that really a hostile work environment?
Well, I mean, a lot of it would depend on the story and whether, you know, you're looking for a story among people who are grieving or people who are angry, as opposed to, there are all kinds of different stories. Don't you think it would be a function of, you know, what the story is and how welcome your presence would therefore be to the people involved in it?
Yeah, absolutely. And also in the newsroom, the dynamics in the newsroom can be, can vary wildly depending on who's calling the shots that day.
My sense reading your book was that there's so much pressure to get the story first and to get it up on the web more than it is to print, that creates more pressure than maybe in the old days when, you know, you'd go out in the field and then you'd, you know, go to a payphone and you'd call up, you know, the night editor and you'd dictate the story and, you know, all that stuff, the stuff of legend and movies and all the rest of it. And now it seems to me that the pressure on the reporter, Jolene, to get there first and deliver the story and perhaps poke at people who didn't want to be poked was more intense. But maybe, you know, I've never been a reporter, so maybe it was like that in the 1930s. It was just a different medium.
Maybe it wasn't so in your face, because it absolutely is digital first. No matter whether you're working for a newspaper or a TV or radio, it is digital first. So you get it on the web and you get it out on social media, because nobody is waiting until X o'clock to find out what's going on.
And images are a big part of it, too. And maybe, you know, people are less happy to have their face in the news than, you know, to have been quoted in the news. So that might be part of it. Well, anyway, tell us about Jolene.
Jolene is, as you mentioned, a reporter here in Phoenix. She's trying to cover real issues in a society that seems obsessed with clicks and reels. And she's trying hard. I'm thinking about the sequel I'm working on right now, and how she's getting interference from all the social media. There is a controversial radio talk show host in Phoenix who dies in a surprising way, and Jolene's managers are ecstatic because she had the last interview before he died. She was the last person to interview him, so they think they've got the advantage. They're going to blow everybody away. But national media decide to arrive in Phoenix, as they like to do when we have a big story here, and they bring bigger budgets, they get better scoops, and Jolene ends up really fighting for her job and her life, ultimately.
No pressure there. Does that seem a little ghoulish? I mean, you know, because she had the last interview? I mean, that's an interesting credential, that the guy died, but the person who talked to him last is the star.
See, that is the reaction from somebody who's not worked in a newsroom. But anybody, and I know there are some here who have or still do work in newsrooms. Yeah, let's not use any living person. I don't know. Who can we think of? Some dead person, if you had the last interview and they died unexpectedly, right? You would be like, oh my gosh, I was the last person to talk to them. What did they say? And it's something to promote. And now that you're looking at me, I feel really gross about that, Barbara.
Sorry, that wasn't my intention at all. I think you're right that probably, you know, a person who's not in news might read this differently than a person who is. But see, I think I read all crime fiction as being educational. It takes me into worlds that I'm not familiar with, and I get to learn stuff and become empathetic in ways that I wouldn't have been had I not. So, I mean, I really felt for Jolene. I wasn't annoyed with her at all. No, I mean, I felt that the pressures on her were, you know, were difficult. And as you say, she really is fighting to survive, because, you know, I have a feeling that you could be yesterday's news in a big hurry if you didn't do your job,
right,
as management wants you to. So this guy, you set him up to be
Larry Lemon.
He is a lemon, right? So we don't necessarily need to say why he is, what it is going on with him, his stance. But I was thinking about it reading the paper today. There was an article about a legislator here who is introducing bills of amazing variety and no particular worth. And I thought about Larry when I was reading that he was kind of that kind of guy.
Larry did try to run for city council and mayor in Southern
That's
Arizona.
Right.
But then he got the call to come to the big city of Phoenix, like I did many, many years ago. Larry is a controversial radio talk show host, and so he has very strong opinions, which I feared actually, Barbara, might be outdated by the time the book published, and they absolutely are not. We are still a country divided, and border security is still an issue. Climate change is still an issue. So Larry Lemon, the talk show host, has very strong opinions, which is helpful because it leads to no shortage of suspects.
Absolutely. absolutely true. There's any number of people he's really pissed off. So, you know, and that's what you want. You know, that's what you want in a murder mystery. You don't want the solution to be so obvious that it's a big yawn. So you have multiple suspects, which means that Jolene, if she's really going to dig into this, has lots of people to talk to.
And, you know, one thing I did, because there is a common criticism when there's a novel featuring a reporter, especially a woman reporter, there's a common criticism of, well, she only gets the inside scoop, or she only figures out what happened because she's sleeping with her source. So that is not the case in Off the Air. In fact, one of her most valuable sources really doesn't like her very much. No. So I wanted to create sort of an interesting dynamic between them. And I think I have, and I want it to continue in a non-sexual relationship. I want to keep it professional because I like it. It's a professional relationship where they don't really like each other, but they have to kind of work together.
I thought that the second victim in this book was going to be the female reporter who comes in and just keeps trying to...
JJ.
Yeah, JJ. JJ, in my view, could be a victim down the road.
You don't like JJ, huh?
Well, you know, she's also fighting to survive and fighting for stories and all.
See,
but
I felt bad because JJ is sort of a composite of a couple of reporters from early on.
Why should you feel bad?
Because I wouldn't want them to be a victim. I mean, I'm older and sweeter now. Like, I'm more laid back now.
Okay. Well, anyway, our problem for Jolene is that, you know, she not only has to try to go after this story, try to keep her job, but she has an intense rival who keeps beating her out or trying to beat her out. And so that's part of the dance in this, too. But all good mysteries really depend on conflict. And so introducing JJ certainly adds to the conflict, right? It's not just a murder. There's other stuff happening.
You need a nemesis.
Yeah. No, that's very true. A bit noir, so to speak. Right. Do you have fun writing this? I mean, aside from the anxiety and, you know, moments and all the rest of it, didn't you really have fun?
I'm starting to have fun now, and I'm enjoying writing the second because I don't know, maybe because I have one under my belt. Not to say I didn't enjoy it, but when you're writing and you have no clue if it's going to ever go anywhere, it's a different feeling than if you have a contract and you know there's going to be a second book, you know?
And you already know your characters. So, world building is, you know, fiction depends on world building. It's not just science fiction or fantasy, but all fiction, you have to make stuff up. So even if, you know, the basis for this is real reporting, you still had to create the characters, you had to create the newsroom, you had to create all this stuff. But now that you've done that in your second book, you have less work to do up front.
Do I? Mm-hmm. So it'll be really easy?
I see we have another editorial conference coming. Well, we already know who Jolene is.
True.
We know who JJ is.
I've lived with them so long in my head that I feel,
But that's my point. You already know who they are. Yeah. And so maybe it's easier now, the second book, to focus on the story and what you want to do because you've already... I mean, you'll bring in new characters. Obviously,
right, sure,
you're
going
to have, and you can't kill the same guy twice, so it's going to have to be something else going on. But I talked to so many authors who write standalones and then so many who write series, and they each make cases for them. The people that write standalones get bored with returning to the same people and the same world, but even more, they're constrained because once you make those early decisions, I mentioned Michael and Harry, once he decided that Harry would get a year older with every book, he couldn't really go back. Mm-hmm. And so eventually he got too old to work at the LAPD. So all those decisions you make in your first book, you really can't escape them, even if you later... Laurie King once said that writing a first novel is like packing a trunk. You know, you put stuff in it, and some of it you wish you hadn't, and some of it you could take out later.
Yeah.
And this is also the reason, I think, why people who write long series very often write prequels, because you start your series with your characters at a moment in time. They're a certain age, and they're a certain job, and all the rest of it. But as you write them, you start to wonder, and readers start to wonder, what happened before? Mm-hmm. You know, what brought them to Phoenix? What did this or that? And you don't have room in the first novel to write like a whole biography.
Right.
So I love the fact that prequels often come along, and I think those are really fun. So how many of you have read prequels to series? Yep. And it's always fun, isn't it, when you... And you have sort of have an inside track, because if it's a prequel, you, the reader, know more than the character in the prequel about his life or her life and what's going to happen. I think I've said this before here. Charles Finch has written a wonderful Victorian mystery series. And after, I don't know, 12 books or something, he thought he'd write a prequel. And then when he wrote the prequel, there was more to that. So he ended up writing a trilogy prequel, which I've always thought was great. And it was fun to read, because the people that you were reading about in the prequel, you knew how things had come out. Not necessarily if there was a crime, but you knew how their lives had developed. And you knew it and they didn't. So it gave you sort of, as a reader, sort of a, you know, godlike feeling. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed that. So at some point, if you carry on with Jolene, you know, you may decide you want to
go backwards. Huh?
Well, or you can just include more of her story in whatever it is you're going forward. But the good news is that this is the start of a series, at least two books,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. And hopefully more, because I do have plenty of ideas for her and plenty of places in Phoenix that I want to share with people outside of Phoenix as well.
Wonderful. So the case progresses, and we can't tell you any more than that without spoiling the book. But can we? No, I don't think there's anything else.
There's just
much.
Lots of suspects, because he's a controversial radio talk show
right.
host. And we
so the two questions are, who killed him, and will Jolene get to keep her job, right? Those are the basic cures.
See, I love that those are the questions. So somebody today, earlier today, said, describe Jolene as having a chip on her shoulder because she lost an Emmy. And I'm laughing because that was like the smallest little detail, but it was real life for me.
Ah, well, tell us that story.
Can you believe that? I was like, it was interesting to me. It was a reporter and not a TV reporter who picked up on that. And I thought that was so interesting. It was such a, okay, so it's very early in the book. It's probably the first or second chapter. There's a reference to Jolene being nominated for an Emmy, and she was up against a story that she was sure would not win. In real life, I was up for an Emmy for a feature about a blowfish going to the dentist. Barbara, a fish, exactly. That reaction should have been automatic Emmy, right? Guess what I lost to?
I don't know.
A story about bubble wrap.
Are you kidding me?
I am not. I know, that was my reaction as well. So this was like 15 years ago. Wait, this gets better, because this shows how, I was going to say petty, but maybe how I've evolved. Because
wrapped in bubble wrap all the way while you were evolving.
So I decided to track down the guy who won the bubble wrap, since I was not very gracious that night 15 years ago. I was not thinking nice thoughts about him. And it was hard. He was not the easiest person to find. Dave Hecht, if you're out there, he is now a public affairs officer in the Navy. He works out in Virginia. So I just had a conversation with him a couple of days ago. I know. And I apologized. I said, I want to offer you sincere congratulations. It's belated, but really it's sincere. And then I sent him a book. And you know what? And I bubble wrapped the book.
You really have evolved. What a good person you are. I'm so impressed. So one of the characteristics of Jolene is her preferred diet, which explains why we have these particular snacks here. So tell us about that.
Thank you. Oh, my gosh. So today we got a call. Well, first, one of my very favorite snacks ever is Food City Chips and Salsa. So if you've not tried it and you're able to, please do Food City Chips and Salsa. I made it just easy. That's what my main character also loves snacking on. And today I got an email from Food City, and they said, hey, could we bring some chips and salsa tonight? I said, Barbara, can they? She said, sure, we can set up a table. So we have chips and salsa. That's one. And then we also have a sweet snack that I brought. And I have to give credit to my husband, because he put the mints in the bags and tied them up and put cards in the bags. But they're from Soretta's French Mints. They're based in Glendale. It's a family-owned. And the mints appear in an Emmy scene. They're not up for an Emmy. They're just on the table as a little sweet treat.
Wow, product placement, a new frontier in crime fiction.
No, it's very sincere.
I know it is, but I love it because I know that Greg Hurwitz writes about a particular brand of liquor and they send him bottles. And the late Peter Robinson went to Australia and then featured a Shiraz from an Australian vineyard and they sent him a case, you know, so it does happen that...
Jolene drinks Pepsi.
Listen, I told you, some of you may have heard this story, which I absolutely love. I was reading the first Spencer novel by the new author, Mike Lupica, who's a lovely guy, and I'm really fond of him. And, of course, they're set in Boston, and in, like, chapter two, Spencer and Susan go to have dinner in a restaurant in Boston that looks out over the Boston Common. The menu sounded terrific. The name of the restaurant, I'm trying to remember, the something bistro and all, and I thought, wow, I wonder, this is a thing, if you're reading your book with a phone near you, you can stop and look stuff up, which is really not a good idea because it knocks you out of the story, but at the same time, so anyway, I looked it up, and it's a real restaurant, and I thought, well, I'm going to Boston to see the John Singer Sargent show, and, you know, we could have dinner, so I opened up OpenTable and tried to make a reservation and came back and said there are no tables till like January 29th or something. I was going on January 7th and I thought, well, it's obviously a really good restaurant because you can't even get in. But then I didn't give up, so I called them and I said, you know, explain my story, why I wanted to come, and I couldn't get a table. And they said, no, there was something wrong with OpenTable. And certainly we could come. So when Dana and I showed up, it was amazing. They took us to the table overlooking the commons. The chef came out and did our own menu. Fabulous wine from, you know, the whole bit. And it was just great. They were so excited to be, wasn't my book, right? I just was reading it. So when I came home, we had one copy left autographed by Mike. So I sent it to them with thanks, so that they could see that. But I mean, I guess my point is that it's wonderful for businesses maybe, but even people to be mentioned in books. It feels
I love reading about that. Don't you?
Yeah.
Well, clearly you do. And the same with like TV shows. I'm kind of annoying to watch a show with because I want to know, does that place really exist? And instead of just enjoying the show, right. I will pull out my phone and do what you just said.
So authors have to be careful with phone numbers. And I was reading a mystery some years ago set in Albuquerque. At which point there's a carjack or something or other. And the license plate looked curiously familiar. So I went out and looked at my car, and it was my license plate.
Oh, my God.
So I wrote to the author, and I said, "Why?" She said, well, she said, you know, I wrote it down. I didn't think you'd really mind. It's okay.
At least it wasn't your personal phone number.
No, it was my license plate, which now long gone because I have a different car. But anyway, but it can be a problem if you do, like, for example, really pick up somebody's real cell phone number and somebody like me with a phone is reading the book and thinks, I'll just call that number and see who answers. So, you know, but I mean, it's almost impossible not to pick up somebody's real phone number if you're making one up. There are only so many digits available to you, so you likely would. And if you kill somebody, for example, in the restaurant in Boston, they probably wouldn't have been nearly so happy if they'd been the murder scene.
Right, right.
So, you know, it's a good idea to check with if it's a real place before you kill somebody in it.
Thank you. That is good advice.
It's really good advice, right. So anything else that you would like to say about the book before we open it up to questions?
I just want to say thank you to you and thank you to everybody who showed up because I have been in that seat a zillion times and it is your time is valuable and I really appreciate it. And anybody who's watching online, hello. I know my brother is in Washington, D.C. Hi, Philip.
Hi there.
Hi, Ellis. So I just do really want to thank because I'm very grateful and Phoenix has been really, really, really wonderful. Like, I don't know this for a fact, but my gut is that the publisher is kind of impressed with how Phoenix is responding to this because, as you know, pre-orders are a thing, and it's...
Well, publishers tend to look over the Hudson all the way to California, missing whatever is down below. So, yes, it probably does make an impression. I would like to give a shout-out to Christina, who faithfully comes to many, many of our author events, and she photographs them for me so I can use her photos on Instagram. And recently, one of her photos made it into two of the leading book trade publications. You were there for Publishers Weekly and Shelf Awareness.
Wow, thank you. Wait, can I just quickly tell you something? Because this, I am so, you said for your Instagram, Barbara had to train me though to take the photos the right way because I was Miss Horizontal. So last night I did my very first Instagram Live.
Yeah.
Vanessa Lilly.
I saw.
Sister.
Right.
You saw it? Did you? Oh my gosh. She told, I said, Vanessa, I don't know anything about this. She goes, just have your phone on. It'll be fine. I'm like, okay. So I set up, ready to go. Guess who's sideways? Everybody else was this way, and I was this way.
That's right. I know. I have. I'm doing two Australian authors on tomorrow, and one of them just wrote me in a panic because I sent her the Zoom link, which clearly says tomorrow, but tomorrow in Australia is actually not tomorrow, right? Tomorrow in Australia is Wednesday, but she had it down today. So where was I? And I said, you know, you have to look this stuff up. It's 18 hours between here and Sydney.
Gosh.
So 6 o'clock here is 12 o'clock the next day in Sydney. And I'm telling you that there are publishers in New York who have actually said to me, oh, we have this great new author from New Zealand, but there's nothing you can do with him. To which I reply, it's only 14 hours, I say, to Auckland, and sure I can do this. You know what I mean? Isn't it interesting how, you know, time zones are really hard for people. And our time zone in particular is really hard for people.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And so basically, the only way to make most people understand it is just to say we're on Pacific Daylight Time because they absolutely do not know what to do with Mountain Standard Time while everybody else is. But Facebook corrects it to Mountain Standard Time a lot of the time. They just won't accept the idea. So it's very confusing. But anyway, there we are. Christina did make a list of off-the-air discussion guide questions, and we only have one left, and I think I gave one to almost everybody. But if you're missing one, we could probably copy this for you if you'd like to have one when you leave. Don't read it till after you finish the book. That'll be a really bad idea.
It's
no,
on my website.
You were going to cheat, weren't you? I saw you looking.
No, Aaron, I did that too. Yeah.
Chagrined. All right, so questions from the audience. And I know we have two Phoenix authors here, so maybe you would like to speak about what it's like to write here in this wasteland of authors.
Paige, those are very personal questions. Process. Oh, I'm so sorry. Thank you. See, she has to also instruct me to do this.
No,
so Paige Shelton, Arizona author, had two questions. One, what is my writing process? And two, is this my very first completed novel? One, I'm still working on my process. I know you're supposed to write, or well, people say you should write every day, and that's not always doable. And I'm still working on my process. I'll let you know when I get it down. This is technically my first novel. I wrote something that I thought was a novel, but I don't think 40,000 words is considered a novel because clearly nobody was interested when I tried to pitch it to people.
It's
so.
A little short.
Yeah.
It's a novella. It's a novel with an L.A. on the end.
So this would be, I think, my first completed novel because the other one doesn't count. Because it was too short, which is why no one wanted to represent me.
Well, luckily for you, there are things called Amazon Shorts and other things. So, you know, don't throw it away because it might have a life of its own at some point. Right. Right. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
Oh, wait. Sorry. I forgot. Jen, the other author.
Oh,
right.
Hi, Michelle.
Wait, Jen.
Yes, she asked about the main character's name, Jolene. Jolene is named after Dolly Parton's song. Her mother named her after that. And, oh my gosh, Jen, thanks for asking because I just found out that Beyonce's new album is dropping this week, country album, and the rumor is she does a cover of Jolene. I think she did that for me, but I'm not positive, but we'll see. I'm going to go with it. Isn't that great? So it'll be Dolly's song and Beyonce's version that we will be hopefully singing.
So next time you're here, you can walk into Strains of Jolene. I know. That'd be a great idea. Love it.
Got that, Patrick?
Right. Yes, ma'am. Did you have a question?
Christina, when did you first know or realize, I really do want to be a writer?
You guys are asking like really thoughtful questions. So Michelle asked, when did I realize I really wanted to be a writer? And that means the translation is, when I'm going to start saying no to other things and really do the writing. Because 15 years ago, I was like, I'm going to write a book. 15 years. So clearly it took me a long time before I realized that I needed to learn the craft. That was the key. I thought, like, I'm a reporter. I write every day. How hard can it be to write a book? Oh, yeah, exactly. It's hard. It's a whole different world.
Remember I said that fiction is about making things up, and that's not what reporters are supposed to do.
And neither do I want to read necessarily an 80,000-word news story. So, it was when I really decided. I just felt like, I don't know how to describe it, but it was just like this sort of seriousness that overtook me. And I started saying no to things, and that was my priority, right? Like, I don't watch Netflix a lot. I don't really binge a lot of the series, unless I can't sleep well, then I do. But I'm saying no to a lot of things, so that's my priority. And I'm glad, I mean, I'm really grateful to have the opportunity, you know, because when you're writing, when you don't have a contract or know what's going to happen, it's tougher, I feel like, to write than it is when you have. And I know I've heard other authors say, oh my gosh, it's hard when you have a contract. And I remember going, what are you talking about? And because I hadn't been published, right? And I feel like it's not easier, but I feel like at least I like have a reason to continue because there are expectations. There's a deadline and hopefully, you know, more books coming. So I'm sorry, a really long answer, but it took me really, I mean, it took years before I was like, yeah, this is really what I want to do. So.
Right. There are many authors who sat up there and said, you know, they had day jobs when they wrote their first book or two. And so they could hardly wait until they made enough money writing so they could quit their day job. But somehow or other, all that extra time never appeared because once they quit their day job, there were other things that got in the way. So
like
it's
social
really
media.
Well, yes. But I mean, you know, discipline is truly required. Yeah. If you want to be a published writer, you know, you do have to make time for it. You do have to be disciplined, whether you have a real, you know, another job mm-hmm. or whether you have. Or that is your job.
Because we all have responsibilities, whether it's a day job or family or friends or medical issue, whatever. We all have responsibilities. And so nobody's got it easy writing. I can't remember. Somebody quoted Tess Gerritsen as saying this, and I have not confirmed it. So I would not go on the air with this, but I guess I am because I'm sharing it and you're recording this, aren't you? So somebody attributed this to Tess Gerritsen that to be a published author requires two of three things. So talent, perseverance, or luck/timing. If you have two of those three things.
Tess was a medical doctor before she, you know, decided to be a writer.
Author,
so
yes.
Yeah, she's a wonderful author. I'm very fond of Tess, but you know, she had a all-consuming profession. So I think she did eventually have to retire. She started writing romances for Harlequin. I always love that because she writes some of the darkest mysteries, and I, you know, she evolved
yes.
a whole different direction. And that's another thing that I think is interesting is the voice you have now may evolve. You may evolve in some other direction that neither of us currently could anticipate.
Yeah, and I have a little bit of a clue where Jolene's going, at least with her personal life.
No, but I mean, you might decide to write some other kind of story mm-hmm. right now.
Yeah, not in Jolene's voice, right. Not in first person, yeah.
Right, yeah, a lot of different things. Yes, ma'am.
She was stretching.
Oh, sorry. I thought your hand was up. Okay, Patrick, do we have questions?
There is one. Renee would like to know, what did you learn about yourself by writing off the air?
This is such a deep audience. Oh, my gosh. So Renee's question is, what did I learn about myself writing off the air? That I'm I already knew I was stubborn. That I'm not a quitter. Because I really believe that Jolene had a good story. And it was just as Tess, or as somebody claims Tess said, perseverance is one of the three ways to get published. And so that definitely, for sure, I'm not a quitter.
And that's a wonderful thing to know about yourself. Mm-hmm. Right. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
I have a two-part question, just to stop you. One is, what did you find through this process was the most surprising thing to you, and what was the most rewarding thing? At this point in the process, you've got a book out there now.
The most surprising is that I'm not sobbing right now because I was sure I was going to cry. So I'm really proud of myself. In all seriousness, so Aaron's question is, what was most surprising and what's been most rewarding so far? What's surprising is how many hands touch your work. I had no idea. I mean, there's the editor, and then there's a copy editor, and the person that creates, David Rothstein created this beautiful cover, and the people that figure out the fonts, and the people that print and put them in boxes and ship them to you, and then you guys put them in. Like, so many people are involved in getting the book from here, here.
That's absolutely true. Do you all know that Christina owns the copyright to the words to the story, but the publisher actually owns the copyright to the production? So the artwork, they even can own the title, or at least they can dictate the title. The type, you know, the whole way the book is printed, all the rest of it belongs to the publisher. So authors, many of you may think that, you know, Christina did the cover. Was this your title?
It was.
It was. So that's a good thing, because many times, you know, they decide there's a more marketable, a more market-friendly title than the one. Some authors just call it new book, you know, number six or something, because they give up on the whole idea that they're ever going to be able to. If you come for Lisa Scottolini Wednesday night, she has some hilarious stories like that. But, you know.
I will be here.
So. Okay. Well, you know, and I really want to give a shout out to Christina. She says no to many things she says, but she hardly ever misses an author, and especially a debut author. And it's so important that a first-time author gets all you lovely people here. And, you know, it's hard just to talk to empty chairs and me. So we've done it, but it's not the ideal thing, but I'm so appreciative of Christina's support for other authors, and also for Paige and Jen, who come very often as authors themselves. They come to our events and support other authors, which I'm glad of. I'm hoping that we do get more Phoenix authors, you know, or in this community. Metro Phoenix, do you all know that Metro Phoenix is the largest city geographically? It's bigger than Los Angeles. You know, it's fifth biggest in population, but and there are no actual western boundaries. So, you know, you can grow all the way to California and probably can go all the way to Tucson. In fact, I would guess that eventually Tucson and Phoenix will be largely, especially if they ever put the train in.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And anybody who's driven I-10 to Tucson can hardly wait for the train to go in. Lord, I didn't go to the Tucson Festival of Books, despite invitations, because I just couldn't face the traffic. I had an event on Saturday, and it wasn't worth it for one day to battle up and down 10.
Yeah, I went. It was, I mean, it can be a challenge.
It really can. Right. Anyone else with a question? You're still stretching. not gonna call
it here. When she's talking. Thank you. So the question is, did I start it wanting it to be a series? And the short answer is yes. I've always wanted to write a series because I love them. And I really love Jolene, which I know sounds weird to some people, because I've heard some authors say, my character is a character, not a person. And I know my character is not a person, but I still love her and I care about her. And so I don't know if that sounds weird or not, but...
I think authors actually spend more time with their characters than they do with their nearest and dearest. I read somewhere that, you know, an author while drinking alone at Starbucks is actually in a crowd. And I think that's probably true to a great extent. It's fairly rare that a publisher invests in a one book contract. I mean, it does happen, and I can come up with instances. We had a debut novel earlier this year was a one book contract. But when they go to all that work and all that expense to, you know, get an author, sign them up, produce the book, and market it in the whole bit, the payoff isn't that great for a single book as a rule. So usually it's two. And sometimes it's more once they're established. But two is not unusual. Did they give you a two-book contract at the outset?
No.
No?
So it's...
They waited to see if it would...
Yeah, and that's why I'm really grateful to Phoenix, because I really feel like they came through and showed that they want to support a local series. So I keep saying that. I should probably ask and get solid proof, but I really believe that the local support helped.
Well, and here you all are. I actually had to go back and order more books, so that's a very good sign. You know that only 20% of our customers live here? Think about it.
So thank you.
You guys are great.
You guys are really special.
If you notice the packing materials out the back and the rest of the building, I could give you an example. We did a fundraiser for the Authors Guild, which was set up to do different things all around the country because there were 30-some authors involved, Margaret Atwood, John Grisham, whatever. And our pair of authors were Douglas Preston and Diana Gabaldon. So we had about 70 people that came to the event, and we've shipped over 1,500 copies so far. So that's kind of the ratio that we have here.
You're giving UPS a run for the money.
No, it's just Scottsdale is a tourist destination. When we opened over on Main Street in 1989, it was the Art Gallery X, you know, Nexus, and then the art market collapsed. But nobody who came into the early Poison Pen actually lived here. People didn't live in downtown Scottsdale. Everybody was a tourist. So, you know, it was sort of like a no-brainer to, on day three, put down a yellow pad and say, sign here and I will write to you.
Yeah,
and then I went home and
letters.
Asked my husband, I said, will anyone care if I write to them and, you know, what I have to say? And he said, well, you know, try it. You won't know unless you do. But it's always, and then COVID really accelerated that because, you know, we were doing Zoom events like two or three a day. And so people, you know, keep coming. So
I know when I'm not here, I'm watching you on.
Well, but I mean, the point is that people keep buying books from us who don't live here. Mm-hmm. And it just gets bigger all the time. So
the point is I should quit saying thank you, Phoenix, and also thank other people. Is that what you're saying?
Actually, yes, but I hadn't thought about it till you said that.
Thank you, everyone.
But you know, it's an interesting, and I have no idea why it's worked out this way. We don't have an advertising budget. We don't have a marketing budget. We don't do anything. We just open the door and people wander in. It's great. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. The question is about the local places that are mentioned in Off the Air. And I mentioned neighborhoods as well as real businesses. And every place, thank you, Nancy, for asking that. I mean, every place has a special reason why I included. So the Melrose neighborhood is in there, Maryvale, Sunny Slope, downtown, Levine. And then businesses I mentioned, we already talked about Food City and Soretta's French Mints. But I included Rito's Mexican Food. I included both the original location on Roosevelt as well as the fancy one on 7th Street near Bethany Home because that was one of the very first places one of my favorite photographers, Isaac Cadriel, took me. So that was a special place. Harlow's Cafe in Tempe is another place that another photographer that I really like, Bill Miley, he took me there. So I have special memories. They'll see Nancy knows him. Nancy just clutched her heart. And then Chicago Hamburger Company, which is based in Phoenix, is included because the owner, Bob Papandouras, actually helped me with a story early in the pandemic. I wanted to follow some restaurants for a year, like very early on. Remember when it was like crazy? No one knew what was going to happen. We were just, it was a scary time. And I said, Bob, I want to follow you, but for a year, and you need to be okay with me checking in and asking really personal questions. And he did. Like three or four times, like really opened up to me. And I was like, he's going in the book. And it's a key scene too. So Bob has a speaking role. Is it a speaking role in a book? I don't know. So he's like for real in there. I don't see Bob in the audience, but I know that that he's got
the book. You just raised an interesting question. Is there an audio book?
There is.
Aha.
Uh-huh. Oh,
now that would be a speaking part.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, thank you. And you know what? I heard a sample and just burst into tears because it was so bizarre. It'd only been me in my head.
So you heard the voice now from somebody
else.
It
was in first person, right? Yeah. She's Jolene. She's saying I. And I was like, wait. It was so, and the fact that I loved her voice and she sounds like a friend telling a story, which is really all I wanted. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's great. So.
That's that luck part that Tess was mentioning,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
For yeah, for sure.
For sure. Anyone else? Any more questions, Patrick?
Yeah, actually.
This is the online audience that Patrick is reading the question.
Right. Your fellow Minotaur author, Bruce, is it Borgos?
Hey,
he's
Bruce.
Tuning in. Great guy.
Hey, Bruce. We'll see you on July 18th.
Yeah, and you've already kind of addressed this a little bit, but he wants to know, did you pants this book or plot it? And were you surprised along the way with the direction your story took? You don't have to repeat that because I got the mic.
I want to know when pants became a verb.
Sorry, it's okay.
Bruce, we're going to talk about your about your grammar.
Yeah, I don't think Bruce is a plotter. I saw him at the Tucson Festival of Books. I don't think he's a big plotter, but I don't know what the heck I was for this first one. I was everything. For the second book, I'm trying to be a plotter, but it's going so. There's another wonderful local author in the audience. Allison Brennan is here, and she saved my life. I had to write a synopsis to give my editor for the second book, and I was like, "What is it?" It was like it was hard. I felt like it was harder than the first book. I promise it's going to be a good book, but they don't just take your word for it. They want a little bit more. So, I'm trying to plot the second one, and it's working pretty well, but certainly not, you know, anybody who does it. I've heard them a zillion times say, yeah, I have an idea of what it's going to be about, but sometimes it takes turns, and that's what happens because it's a creative process.
I don't know. I think being a pantser would be easier once you've written more, but I don't know that for sure.
The right. Terror would be less, maybe.
So, Allison, I apologize for not saying hi. I haven't been to any of your events for so long. John does them. So I didn't recognize you. My apologies. So nice to see you. Oh, wow.
Gosh.
Well, very nice.
Thank you so much. I should have met you and had my daiquiri. That's so
We've known Allison for years when you lived in California, right? And we used to, or somewhere else.
But,
right, and now you live here, but anyway, it's lovely to see you, so thank you very much. I didn't slight you on purpose, so thank you very much for coming. Anything else?
Yeah, let's see. Well, somebody named, Miss Brianna is her handle on the...
Wait, is that Brianna who was here? I met them. She's from Sacramento. They were just here a couple weeks
ago. That's it, yeah.
Hey, Brianna.
She says, you look stunning in the pink. But no, the question, here's another one. Question from Sarah from California. Did you find having a reporting background a benefit or a challenge when it came to developing your supporting characters?
Thank you. And you know what? I think that's Bree's friend. And I'm going to screw up her name, but you might know this. Because she says everybody screws up her name because they think Siri or Suri, but it's actually named after a character in an old Western. Anyway, it's not Sarah.
She put Sarah in quotation marks, so that.
Oh, okay.
That
it's a pretty name, and I can't remember what it is. But as far as the supporting characters go, they were really easy to come up with because I just really pulled on my experience. And some are composites. And you know what I had to do with this? I had to scale back names. Like there were so many names in here of people that I really like. Or combine their names, you know, like my favorite TV news director is Bob Sullivan. He's not in TV news anymore. So my news director in here is named Bob in honor of him. Bob Papandouras has his real name from the Chicago Hamburger Company in there. But I was able to combine, put people's names in there I wanted, but then I had too many names. And so I had to take some out, which killed me because you want to show love. And at the time I was writing that, I had no idea. This might've been my only book. So I was trying to like put everything in there. And
so
you read an early copy, so you don't know that there's a coffee shop named Barbara's Brew in there.
No, I don't. How about that? Actually, one of the things that writers have to learn is that you can't have too many characters in a book with similar or the same name. If you have three people named James in the book, it's going to lead to dramatic confusion on the part of the reader. Well, no, not angry, but it's just that it's hard to, you need to have characters be distinct so that the reader doesn't say, wait, which Bob is it, you know, in the story.
Yeah, some authors will really avoid putting characters with the same first names. But in my case, Jolene and JJ, I don't know, they go together, so.
Oh, they sound different.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. Anything else?
So you have free food hookups all over the valley is what you're saying.
No, I do not. But yes, we are kind enough again. Enjoy the chips and salsa and the French mints. The French mints I bought. I don't want anybody thinking there's some quid pro quo going on. And Food City was a surprise to get that email today.
Thank you very much, Food City. It was wonderful. So all of you, when you leave, there are so many chips. You feel free. Take a bag with you. Right. Anyway, thank you very much for coming tonight. Let's give Christine another round of applause.
Thank you all so much. Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.